This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. My guest is Jack Driscoll. He is the author of 4 books of poetry, 2 short story collections, and 4 novels. Jack Driscoll is the recipient of numerous grants and awards, including an NEA, Creative Writing Fellowship, and 2 Pushcart Prizes. His latest collection of short stories is called The World of a Few Minutes Ago. He lives in Michigan. We began the interview talking about how he developed a love of language and the desire to write.
When I trace it back to its beginnings, it seems as if I started writing when I was 11 years old, which, by the way, the actuarial tables tells us is the year in which you are least likely to die. So in retrospect, it seems like a propitious place to begin. And because I disliked school so intensely, I thought of it as a place where mostly bad things happened. I would create a quiet space for myself in the midst of noise or chaos, usually by moving, if I had the option, to the back row, where I used to just doodle with words. And mostly it was rhyming words, maybe even monosyllabic rhyming words like love and dove. And then as I got more ambitious, maybe it would be something more like, practical and pterodactyl, something like that. And so it was just this fooling around with language. It's, you know, what I call doodling. And then when I became more serious about it, I began by writing poems or attempting to write poems. And maybe when you're talking about a musical quality or a musical matrix, the sound of the language itself, I think that's called, I think those of us who do this are called logophiles, people who fall in love with language. But maybe the prose sentences or the prose rhythms are just a byproduct of having written poems and only poems for about the first 30 years of my writing life. I mean, now that we've been talking about this for a couple of minutes, I think one of my early juvenile motivations for writing poems was manipulation. And it was, in fact, a way to make girls attracted to me, perhaps to see me in this other light, in this language light, in a more romantic light. Maybe it functioned in that way.
Did it work?
I think probably not. I don't know.
You started out as a poet, moved to short stories, then novels. And one thing you've said is that writing has gotten harder and harder for you. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that, because one might think that if you've been doing this for many years, it should be getting easier.
I was hired in 1975 to come out to Interlaken. And with one other person, I started what is now the Interlaken Center for the AIDS Creative Writing Department. And I was also in charge of the Visiting Writers series. And I invited William Meredith early on. This was probably 1976, and I was still in my 20s and naive. And I asked him what he considered to be a productive year. How many poems would he feel good about having produced? Keepers. And he paused. He was so dignified and attentive. And he looked at me and he said, 6. If I wrote 6 keeper poems, I would feel as if I had had a productive year. And I thought, 6? I can do that over the weekend. And now, all these years later, I understand implicitly what he said and how smart that was. The reason story writing gets more difficult for me is because I'm asking a little more of each next story. One of the dangers of writing the same story, what I call self-imitation, as if we had a template for it, is that you start to imitate. The story becomes too easy to write, which means that you're sort of languishing in that same place. And instead of trying to break through that place where you haven't quite arrived, that story that you haven't yet written, that's different, a little bit different, and maybe in that way a little bit better than anything you've done before. So you're raising the bar. And just because you've written one successful story does not ensure you're going to write another successful story, because every story will teach you what you need to learn in order for that story to get made. So I have gotten inordinately slow. I write long, long hours, and if I come out, say, after a 6 or an 8 hour stint in the chair with one paragraph that I think is worth saving, I've had a productive day.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Jack Driscoll. His latest short story collection is called The World of a Few Minutes Ago. Can you explain a little more something you said earlier? You mentioned that it takes you so long now because you are upping the standards. Are you talking about the language or the plot or something else? I'm wondering what that means.
I'm not sure I can define all of it, but I can sense it when I'm doing it. For example, if I start writing from the point of view of a 15-year-old boy and locate the story in northern Michigan during the winter, I know it's a story I've written before, and I'll immediately turn away from it. Or at least I'll ask myself if there's something I can do, given its parameters, that I haven't yet come to. What I would rather do, what I prefer to do now, is, well, the title story in The World of a Few Minutes Ago is told from the point of view of a 77-year-old former AP photographer. That was brand new to me. I was rereading for, I don't know, the 10th, 20th time, William Gass's In the Heart of the Heart of the Country, in which the speaker says, "I am all my ages." And I have been all of my ages when divining point of view characters, until I had written a story from the point of view of a 77-year-old man. I'm a ways from there yet. And so that's what I mean. And the story that I just finished just a couple of weeks ago is told from the point of view of a troubled and in trouble 15-year-old girl. So it could be a matter of point of view. It could be a matter of linguistics, a matter of seeing how perfectly distilled I can make the language. The danger with that is that you start to, it becomes too incantatory. It becomes too much about language, and therefore it becomes a little bit too much about me. And that is, it becomes a kind of private delight. So I can get myself in trouble that way, where I'm trying to push the language beyond what the story can contain.
Do most of your stories come to you in an image? Do you get ideas from newspaper clippings? How do your stories become a story? Because we get so much stimulation every day, and yeah, you probably get so many ideas. What rises to the level of an idea becoming a story for you? And
yeah.
How does that start?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's this sensory bombardment every day. We wake up and look out at the world. And I'm not sure that we can even formulate a good response to it all. But somewhere in there, I suppose, are the seeds of stories. First of all, I don't even have an inchoate sense of what the story is going to be. And that's a result, I think, of having written poems and only poems for all those years. I believed then if I could get an interesting first line, a line interesting enough to me, then I could get a second line, which would announce what the third line might be, and I would come to the end of the poem never having had a clue or an inkling of what that poem was going to be. And that's the same way in which I write a story. So I never have a plot in mind. I don't know where it's headed. I don't know where it's going to end. I really do not know what's going to happen in the sentence yet to be written. And the sentence that is written, again, announces what's possible in sentence number two, and I will never move to sentence number two until I'm certain at the time of composition that the sentence is right. So I just keep following hunches. I also, by the way, worry a lot. But here's how a story that is going to appear in, I think, the upcoming issue of Prairie Schooner happened this way. And it's not, and this is the way I think that most of my stories occur. Vince Gilligan is the creator and lead writer for Breaking Bad, and he's a former Interlochen student of mine who, I don't know, 30 years after leaving, got in touch with me to ask if I was if I would show him around the campus. He was coming back. And so I spent a couple of hours walking around campus, and he was a visual arts major when he was here, and more than anything wanted to go into the art building. And so we did. And he started to revert to being 15 again, which was how old he was when he studied in I think it was an intro to creative writing class with me. And he related the story whereby the teacher, his art teacher, had brought in a bunch of tracheotomy tubes, and they melted the pure silver down, and he made, out of the silver, he made his mother a pair of earrings. And we talked and walked, and later that night I thought, how beautiful that was, this walk around. And what stuck with me, you asked, does image ever start this? And in this case, the answer is yes. I could not get those tracheotomy tubes out of my mind. And so I wrote a story about alchemy. And in fact, I dedicated the story to Vince Gilligan. Now, that's one example of how a story got started. But what was that story going to be? I had no clue. I had absolutely no idea where it was headed or where it would end.
So I could see that there's probably some fear and anxiety when you're staring at the page and you're like, what's next?
Absolutely. It's, in fact, I mean, we can't be prescriptive about these things. I can't tell anybody how she or he should write, and nobody else should do that either. We're going to get to the end of our stories and the quirky ways in which we do. I mean, one thing we know about the human brain is that no two minds are alike. And so much of this is dictated by personality. So I just have to feel that this is the way in which I can do it, and there's no other way. But I would not advise anybody else to even try and do it my way. It's way too frightening.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Jack Driscoll. His latest short story collection is called The World of a Few Minutes Ago. What do you think the role is between memory and fiction?
Well, first of all, I've gotten very interested, thus the title of my recent collection, The World of a Few Minutes Ago. I've gotten really interested in the whole concept of time and how it works. Galway Connell has a gorgeous poem called The Road Between Here and There, in which the speaker says, "Here I sat by the river steaming boulder and considered time, which is next to nothing, merely what vanishes and yet can make one's elbows nearly pierce one's thighs." And the poet Ed Hirsch says, "The moment pulls out of the station on time." And I've been fascinated by that, by time, and by the notion of composite time, or what we might call the superimposition of time. That is, the capacity of the human mind to live both in the past and the present concurrently, as if they exist concurrently, so we can live there simultaneously. And there's even a word for this. It's called stereoscopic time, which is exactly that, living in the past and the present at the same time. And so memory, in fact, can become a storehouse of information. If we don't have the capacity of memory, we have nothing to write about.
Well, you were talking about The World of a Few Minutes Ago, which is the title of your short story collection. Was time an element for you when you were trying to bind these stories together, or did you sort of, when you were writing them, or did you sort of see that connection later?
Yeah, I was not conscious of it. I was not conscious. Theme is a byproduct of writing. And hopefully writing well. And it's nothing I sit down thinking about. And I used to find out what my themes were, or my obsessions, or my focus, by reading reviews. And, you know, reviewers would point these things out. I never once sat down thinking I'm going to write a story that confronts time, but that's in fact exactly what I was doing. You know, in geologic time, it's clear how brief our stay here is. And I don't find that debilitating in any way or depressing. I actually like it, the idea that that this life is finite, and that waking up every day, we need to observe it and observe it closely and then give it back. in one way or another, it certainly did get into these stories. And most particular, I think, as you might suspect, when the story is spoken from the point of view of that 77-year-old fellow, the entire story takes place in his backyard, except at the end when he walks into the house. But the story is all in flashback. It's all about how he arrived on this particular night, sipping a brandy and thinking about the things he's thinking about, reminding himself that maybe his route to this place on this night, standing under the stars in the backyard, was not clandestine, that maybe there was some order to it, or maybe even some providence or fate about it. So it's there, but no, not consciously.
I'm wondering if you could read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer.
Yes, I'm going to read just the first 2 minutes of Richard Ford's The Sports Writer. My name is Frank Boscom. I am a sports writer. For the past 14 years, I have lived here at 19 Hoving Road, Haddam, New Jersey, in a large Tudor house bought when a book of short stories I wrote sold to a movie producer for a lot of money, and seemed to set my wife and me and our three children, two of whom were not even yet born, up for a good life. Just exactly what that good life was, the one I expected, I cannot tell you now exactly, though I wouldn't say it has not come to pass, only that much has come in between. I am no longer married to X, for instance. The child we had when everything was starting has died, though there are two others, as I mentioned, who are alive and wonderful children. I wrote half of a short novel soon after we moved here from New York and then put it in the drawer, where it has been ever since and from which I don't expect to retrieve it unless something I cannot now imagine happens. 12 years ago, when I was 26 and in the blind way of things then, I was offered a job as a sports writer by the editor of a glossy New York sports magazine you have all heard of because of a freelance assignment I had written in a particular way he liked. And to my surprise and everyone else's, I quit writing my novel and accepted. And that is the opening of that, what I think is a gorgeous novel by Richard Ford. If you're asking me what compels here is the quality of the prose itself, which seems to me both patient and assured, and the voice of someone now far enough removed from what he calls the blind way of things then, old enough now, remembering this, and it goes back to your question of memory, to speak not around but directly into the heart of this developing narrative. And that's what I hope for when I begin any novel, that kind of trust in the telling.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest is Jack Driscoll. His latest short story collection is called The World of a Few Minutes Ago. Can you read a short passage from something you wrote that might have been hard to write, or something that changed, or something you feel you succeeded at?
Yes. I'm going to read from the story that I mentioned, The Alchemist's Apprentice, for Vince Gilligan, because of what you just said, a story that might have been hard to write. And it wasn't so hard to write because of the subject matter. It was hard to write because I was in a dark place. And what I mean by dark place is I experienced recently, for the very first time in my writing life, what people refer to as writer's block. I didn't even believe it existed. I didn't believe such a thing as writer's block existed. I thought you just stayed in the chair and whacked away at the keyboard until you wrote through it. And now I'm thinking differently, because for months I was unable to sit down and trust that I could deliver even a single good word. And I'm glad for that experience. It was difficult, but I'm glad for the experience because it taught me something. It taught me that in order to write out of this dark place, this empty vacuum, this void, was going to take my best skills, my best effort. I was going to have to write better than I had, maybe better than I ever had, in order to write myself out of it. So I'm going to read you just a few paragraphs from that. It's called The Alchemist's Apprentice. My mom says she hasn't the foggiest, and that wherever Jimmy Creedy, her stay-over boyfriend, heisted all those tracheotomy tubes is anybody's guess. possibly Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory, I joked, but she just shrugged like, yeah, maybe. For everyone's sake, she asks Jimmy no questions, and neither do I. The less we know, the better. And it's been a few months since he liquefied the pure-grade silver and poured it into cookie molds right there on our kitchen table. Untraceable angels and mermaids and dog bones and bells. Then he double-boxed and packed them like bullion, and sometime after midnight he returned, saying, mm-hmm, and my mom in her nightgown sashaying towards him, and Jimmy already toasting to rubies on the mud flaps, stardust instead of brake lights. That's the way he talks, always high as a kite after a lucrative score, everything in code, and I figured what he meant was that we were all three of us together, suddenly headed for happier times. A godsend is what my mom contends, given our circumstances. He's late 30s like her and handsome as Han Solo, broad cut across the chest but otherwise angular and tall and blue-eyed, easygoing and good-humored, a state of mind that'd been all but snuffed out in our household. He's smart, too, and in ways you might not anticipate. Just last week, he brainstormed some weird wind physics, inversions and updrafts and cross currents, which I then mapped and calibrated and reconstructed for my ninth grade science project. An octagon of box fans arranged around a dunce stool so that when I hit the power switch, the iridescent drawstrings of Evelyn Sackstetter's sweatshirt lifted slow motion sideways and writhed like skinny electric green eels in the darkened classroom. A few girls shrieked, and later Evelyn whispered in my ear, alchemist. She whispered, sorcerer. But it's Jimmy Creedy possesses the magic, the Midas touch, not me. And so that begins that story.
So when you were saying that that was hard to write, are you thinking more of an existential hardness, or was it the words and the story also hard?
Yeah, I don't know what shut down. Given my clear belief that and because I've always in the past been able to write through these blank stretches or, through what people were telling me was the phenomenon of writer's block. And the more I tried, the more I failed at the story. And then self-doubt sets in. And self-doubt is okay because it keeps you attentive and it keeps you focused. And I've also always believed in that as a positive force. But then it morphed into something that seemed almost crippling. Like no matter what word I was going to put down, and or the or a pronoun was the wrong word, a throwaway word. And I just sort of talked myself into thinking that maybe that was it. Maybe I had written all I was going to write, that maybe I'd actually come to the end of this. And that's what I mean by that kind of darkness. So it was a way of sort of bearing up and trusting that over time, if I stayed in the chair and just kept at it, I might actually be able to write my way out. And I did.
Well, where do you write?
My wife and I live on the Little Betsy River between three lakes. And I have attached to the house what I call my crow's nest. And this is what I'm looking out at. I'm looking out at this river, which I'm doing in the moment. It is an aviary, a nesting grounds for wood ducks, mallards, grebes, blue herons, red-shouldered hawks. It is entirely private and surrounded by thousands and thousands of acres of wetland. And my study overlooks all of this from the second floor.
And what do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
What I do make part of my daily ritual is walking. I am a peripatetic, and I like to walk not on roadways, but in the woods. And because I live in a rural area, I'm able to do that either on two tracks or pathways or just through the woods themselves. And so I do it for at least 3 miles every day. I do a lot of my better thinking, maybe even some of my best thinking when I'm walking, when I'm in motion.
And who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I show my work to my wife, Lois, who is a perspicacious reader, and somebody who wants to love my work. And I have learned now, and I even advise students never to give their work to anybody predisposed otherwise. If they are looking for things not to like, they'll find it. And what you want in your perfect reader is somebody who is brutally honest because they want to love your work, and because they want to love your work, they will be the ones to see its deficiencies. And I am one of the great withholders. I will not give up my work ever until I come to that place where there is nothing left that I know how to do to it, to improve it, where I get to that point where I think to try anything else might even hurt the work. And at that point, I read the work to Lois. I read the story to Lois. I don't hand it to her. I read it to her because I want to see how it sounds, not to myself, but to another person. And here are the rules of the house, Mitzi. After I finish, she has to say that she likes it. She has to say, I like it. Or she has to say, even better, I love it. But only for 20 minutes, at which point I come back into the room and I sit down. And then I'm ready to hear it honestly.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Everybody who has ever entered a writing life has dealt with and will in the future continue to deal with it. I think there are some people who might even argue that they're not dispirited by it, but I am. You know, when I get a rejection, it says something. But I never trust a single rejection, and sometimes I don't even trust two or three or four, unless it's the response is consistent. And then I think, okay, I'll let this be helpful in the revision process. And there was a time when I was getting a lot of rejections earlier in my career, and I even put those rejections, I scotch taped them onto my door. And that was the thing I had to pass by before I sat down in those days with what was called a typewriter. But I try to turn it into a positive thing. But yeah, it hurts for the moment in which somebody says, no, it's not up to snuff. It's not you at your best. It's not good enough for us to publish. It hurts, but I don't give up on the stories. I've never given up on a story in my life. And so I turn that toward the process of revision, which the poet William Matthews says is not cleaning up after the party. Revision is the party. And that's rejections from editors who are willing to respond is all part of that revision process.
And what is your favorite word?
I'm going to give you a French word, again, because of where this conversation has gone. And the word is chant de fleur, and it means to be able to laugh and cry at the same time, to be in those two different states of mind, which for me just complicates the emotion, which I like a lot. And I also like how it sounds on the tongue and on the lips when it said chant de fleur. So at least for today, that's my word.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. My guest was Jack Driscoll. He is the author of 4 books of poetry, 2 short story collections, and 4 novels. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft, a dialogue on writing, and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks for listening.